You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In addition to being a professor emeritus at the University of Edinburgh, a bassoonist and founder of a symphony orchestra, Alexander McCall Smith has written over 60 books, many of them as part of serials. In his latest addition to the Isabel Dalhousie series, The Charming Quirks of Others, Mr. Smith ponders the ethical dilemmas of a modern-day philosopher who unwittingly finds herself in the midst of a private investigation. It's published by Pantheon Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Alexander McCall Smith back to our show today. Welcome back.
Thank you very much indeed, Anna.
So between writing a couple of books a year, I guess it is, because 60 books in 30 years, and doing all the other things I mentioned, when do you find time to eat and sleep?
Oh, well, I always find time for that. I suppose writing a fair number of books each year means that I have to be quite careful about my program. And I'm in the fortunate position, I suppose some might consider it unfortunate, of waking up often at 4 a.m. And that's a terribly good time to work. I think that if one can possibly get one's day's work started at 4, it's a great thing. So I sit there and write from 4 until 6 or 7 a.m. and do get quite a lot of writing done. Then I go back to bed.
And I'm assuming you're a fast typist.
Yes, I am, I suppose. I have some bad habits when it comes to typing. I think not all the fingers go onto all the correct keys, but I do write quite quickly.
Now, you're best known for the number one Ladies Detective Agency series, and many of your books feature female protagonists. Why do you choose to write from the female perspective so often?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm not sure how I can answer that question. I am asked that question from time to time, and sometimes people say with surprise, particularly women say with surprise, how can you, a mere man, write from a female
perspective? Oh, I wasn't suggesting that. I was asking rather the appeal of writing from a female perspective. I think some wonderful books have been written by women in a man's mind.
Exactly,
Edith
yes.
Wharton, for example,
yes,
and the other way around. Mm. But a decision has to be made. I'm going to do it that way rather than just rely on my own experiences as a man or as a woman.
Yes, I think that, well, you raise a very interesting issue there about women writing from the male perspective, and that I think you find rather more women writers, female writers, write about men or write from the male perspective than the other way around. I think that it's probably less common for male writers to write from a female perspective. I think the reason why I do it, or I suppose one of the reasons why I do it, is that I find the conversation of women is particularly interesting. It is different from the conversation that men have amongst themselves. I think, you know, we're living in a fairly androgynous society these days, I suppose, but there still are differences of approach. And if you listen to what a group of men in a bar are talking about, it's going to be very different from what a group of women would talk about. So I find that interesting. And I think in relation to, say, the number one Ladies Detective Agency books, where I've got these two main female characters in their little office talking to one another, that conversation is far more fun than if you had two men talking to one another.
Well, in the Dalhousie series, much of it takes place in her mind.
Yes, yes. And there I think that's another thing, I suppose, which I bring out in writing about women, is the subjectivity, the sensitivity to emotional issues which Isabel has. Now, lots of men have that as well, and I think one could equally write about a man thinking that way.
But do you ever pass these by your wife or your two daughters?
Not really. No, I don't. I tend not to involve the family in the books as they're being written. I will often show a manuscript when I finish to them. Well, I do consult my daughters about matters pertaining to dress, because male writers are usually rather bad about describing what women are wearing, because they don't know how to describe it. Is it a top or is it a blouse or whatever? So one of my daughters in particular, when I'm describing shoes, one of my characters often thinks about shoes. I telephone my daughter and say, well, what color would the lining of a good pair of shoes like that be? And I get very accurate advice.
The Isabel Dalhousie series is also something of a detective series, but moral and ethical dilemmas are at the forefront of her work. Didn't you formerly serve as a chairman of the British Medical Journal Ethics Committee?
Yes, I was involved in various public bodies concerned with bioethics in the UK and more broadly in Europe for some time. I was involved in various committees connected with UNESCO, for example, and the Council of Europe as well. So I had that involvement, and I found that very interesting because I think that medical and scientific advance gives rise to all sorts of fascinating ethical issues.
Well, what ethical dilemmas is Isabel face in this latest addition to the series?
Well, it's the usual sort of thing that she faces, in that one of Isabel Dalhousie's problems is deciding the extent of her involvement, because she has an idea that when our lives touch one another, we enter into a relationship of moral proximity to one another or with one another. And so one of the problems that she always has to face is, should I actually get involved in this issue in the first place? And she tends to answer that in the positive and then gets involved in the issue. But she's here concerned, I suppose, with issues of truth-telling, with issues of responsibility for others, and I suppose some issues of fraud as well.
Well, you have also taught medical law, and I'm assuming you've brought some of that experience to these books.
Yes, occasionally I do bring in issues that I was concerned with in my professional existence. There's some fascinating problems that arise in, say, the bioethical field.
I would assume that in the past in medicine, bioethics was not a big issue. You just simply tried to get the person better. Now
yes.
You have all these other factors, and many of them turn out to be political.
Yes, that's right. I think the old-fashioned approach to medical ethics was take a look at the Hippocratic Code and see what it said, and then you could base it on general propositions of treating people well. Now it's much more complex, and I think the political element has entered into that because we have a different conception of the rights of the individual, and the relationship between the doctor and patient has been very much changed by that. And we're also...
Well, that's a legal matter, but wouldn't you also say bioethics is an offshoot of philosophy?
Yes, it is. Yes, I think there are philosophical issues that are very much involved in that. But I think you allude there to political issues, and I think that they are very, very important now in bioethics with all these difficult issues of the way in which we treat various forms of human life and deciding what is human life. The whole issue, for example, of stem cell research brings that into sharp focus.
We're keeping somebody alive when they're in a coma in a state where their brain is dead.
Yeah, that's...
It became a big issue in this country some years back and actually affected some political careers.
Indeed. I think that is a very tricky issue. The whole issue of either passive euthanasia or active euthanasia is very political. And there are a number of Western European countries where there's quite strong debate still going on about assisted suicide, which is a debate that is also obviously an important one in the United States.
Well, so how do we resolve these moral dilemmas? Do we just trust in our instincts of right and wrong, or are there certain guidelines?
Well, I think one approach...
And how would that affect Isabel Dalhousie?
Well, Isabel, I think, is sensitive to the various... philosophical approaches and the formal routes whereby you can actually reach a decision about the rightness or wrongness of something. So she does her morality in a rather different way to the way in which one of my other heroines, Mara Motswe, does. Mara Motswe actually says, well, I know what's right. So she says the old Botswana way is all my instinct. Intuitions, moral intuitions are very important for Mara Matsui. Isabel, however, thinks it out in terms of obligations and rights and matters of that sort, which of course makes it more complicated. I take the view that that we should actually pay attention to our moral instincts, our intuitions as to whether something is right, because they actually can be quite a good guide. That often they will reveal the features of the moral situation to us rather nicely, the moral saliences. And there, I suppose, that takes us to discussions of sympathy for others, and our intuitions are often closely connected with our feelings of sympathy for others, and you can construct a whole moral theory based on sympathy. And Isabel would probably go along with that to quite an extent.
My guest is Alexander McCall Smith. His latest novel is The Charming Quirks of Others, the latest in his Isabel Dalhousie series. And I wonder about writing series, because I've spoken to people who do them. Some talk about feeling at times like they're in a trap, because they not only have to be aware of how the life of their protagonist is changing, but also all the people that they've created to be around them, and they can't just have them all hanging out and doing the same thing, book after book after book. Is that part of the fun of it? And how do you keep track when you're doing more than one series?
Well, it can be difficult. Currently, I'm doing four series and doing a novel in each series each year, so that can be really quite complicated, particularly two of my series, my Scotland Street series and my Corduroy Mansion series, have lots and lots of characters coming in and out of the stories. Yes, it can be difficult. However, there's a tremendous attraction in writing a series, in that when you begin the next book in the series, you don't actually really have to make up and introduce new characters afresh. It's rather like taking up a conversation with somebody that you know quite well. So that's the positive thing. I think also readers rather enjoy the series from that point of view, and that they feel that they know the character and they want to get back to that character. So those are the positive sides, and then there are all these difficulties that you mentioned.
Well, Elmore Leonard told me once that he changes the names, even though for years he wrote the same character. Now he's changed again, and he is writing female protagonists. But for years he just would change the name, because he would sell the book to the movies. They would then own the name, and then the next time he used it, he didn't really own his own name. So why not call him Chili this time and call him Mike the next time?
Yes.
In addition to writing these series, more recently you've also been running a serial for your local newspaper. This is a 19th century thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. A lot of novels in the 19th century, if not most of them, were written on that basis, in that the chapters were published as the author completed them, Dickens being the main example.
Well, but George Gissing wrote a novel, New Grub Street, in which he talked about the difficulties of doing that and keeping up and coming up with a chapter on time, because they would actually penalize you if you didn't hand it in on time.
Well, yes, I haven't been threatened yet about that, but I got into this after a conversation with Armistead Maupin in San Francisco. I was at a party at Amy Tan's, and Armistead was there, and I talked to him about his Tales of the City, his San Francisco serial novel in the papers, and I suppose I was inspired to do my own based in Scotland, and I acknowledged the influence of Armistead Maupin's example there. And then I found that I really enjoyed it, and although in one sense it's a bit frightening knowing that you have to write a chapter a day, it's actually also rather good fun. And that's what I'm doing at the moment. I'm doing a serial novel on the online edition of the Daily Telegraph in London, a chapter a day. So while I'm on this US tour, I have to write a chapter a day at least.
Wow.
And that concentrates the mind. So one has to learn how to write in airplanes.
Well, you may wind up getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning instead. and of course, the number one ladies detective agency series takes place in Botswana. Do you ever go back?
Yes, I go to Botswana every year. I haven't been this year because the time that I normally go was the time when next door in South Africa they were holding the World Cup, Football World Cup, which I wanted to avoid at all costs. So I didn't go to Botswana this year, but I usually do. And I go there just to see how things are changing, to speak to people, to soak up the atmosphere, and often to get ideas for the next Botswana book.
Well, you were raised in Zimbabwe.
That's right,
Rhodesia.
Yes.
Could you go back there? That is one of the sadder countries of the world.
It is. I think things are very difficult in that country. It's a great shame.
And it didn't have to be.
No.
Alexander McCall Smith is the author of the international phenomenon, the number one ladies detective agency series. He's professor emeritus of medical ethics at the University of Edinburgh, and which of course is in Scotland, and author of 60 novels, the most recent one, The Charming Quirks of Others, which is in the Isabel Dalhousie series. It is published by Scribner, is it? No, Pantheon.
Pantheon, yes.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you.